So we seem to have lost one of our members this morning who's...
Oh.
Can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
Marco? So right. I was just saying we seem to have lost one of our new members this morning because she has a conflict with work. I think she got the times mixed up to begin with.
That's right. That's, what's her name?
Katina. Katina Press. Anyway, I've asked if she could, if we shifted the time, if it would make a difference for her. So we'll find out. It might be a problem to shift the time, but...
There was also Marguerite.
Yes, exactly. But she wanted it evenings, and that's... I mean, that could be a possibility, but Donna would... It would put Donna at 3 in the morning or 2 in the morning, so...
It's always a challenge.
It is always a challenge.
It's kind of a funny time for me too, because it's right in the middle of a morning when I would usually be doing things more task-oriented, getting things.
Yeah. Out.
In fact, I think today I have, or I should allow myself just over an hour and then move on, because I have another meeting coming up and clients to respond to and
okay.
Various things in motion. So I'd like to, I indicated some ambivalence.
Yeah, you did.
At the time. but as we're kicking things off, I'd like to.
Well, maybe if we shift the time earlier, it would make it easier, would it?
not for me. Perhaps for others, I'm not sure. I feel like this is a book that many more people should read, honestly. I'm 50 pages in or so, and it's eerie how kind of intimate, historically intimate, the details feel, the narrative feels. It feels like this could be, you know, just around the corner. It could literally be 5 or 6 years from now that the situation is being described or unfolding. And I don't know that much more about the rest of the story, but I've done some background research. And, I've read some of Butler's other work, not a lot, but it feels very timely, I guess.
I agree. And more intimate than I expected, in a way. I finished the first one and I've started in the second one. I kind of felt like I had to read ahead because I'm kind of in charge. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to see where things were going to go.
The opinion seems to be that the second book is preferred or better than the first.
Let's not do that. Winner. Let's be careful. I don't want to be too influenced. I haven't read no commentaries on this book. I've watched the interview on Charlie Rose. There are a couple of other interviews by her or about her. But please, don't tell me that. This is why I'm reluctant to get on fiction calls. Because if people have read chapters ahead of me, and I haven't read this book. I've read other books by her. I get hugely overly influenced. So that it's like worse than seeing a movie before you read the novel, which I never do.
Mm.
If I've read the novel, I don't go see the movie.
I will be disappointed
so many times. I'm just, now you guys can do whatever you want to. I just want to let you know that this is my idiosyncratic response to fiction. I'm not that way about philosophy or psychology or any other field. I'm not influenced very little by whatever anybody else thinks. But about fiction, I'm extremely prone to other people's influences. And it's sometimes very hard for me to get through a novel if I've heard anything through the grapevine about the novel. which is why I never read bestsellers either. I don't read bestsellers, and I only read the minor novels of great novelists. It's the ones that no one ever reads that I'm most interested in.
Hi, Donna.
Hi.
It's great to see you again.
Same here. Great to see everybody.
I read this one. Has anyone read this one? Mind of My Mind, The Wild Seed, The Pattern Master. I've not read Clark Clay's arc, but this is stunning for some of the reasons I think you already mentioned, Marco. She does seem to have been in that, a very visionary mode. So she could fast forward into our collective future, pick out certain patterns, and then she would turn them into an compelling narrative. I think she also, this is also of interest to me, she mentioned that Charlie Rose interview that she read science fiction, but she also read a lot of other stuff. And I was reading Bruce Clark, who's he's a philosopher. He's also into narrative. He's into ecology. And he has a large chapter on Octavia Butler, which I've not read because I wanted to read the novels he's referring to before I read his commentary. But I was really struck by what he said, that she, in a personal communication to him, said that she had read all the works of Lynn Margulis, the biologist, who co-created, I think, with Lovelock, the Gaia hypothesis. So she was very much into a certain kind of biology that Lynn Margulis was putting on the map, which is basically, we're biomes. I mean, we are symbiotic. So without the bacteria in our gut, which are autonomous creatures, in many ways they're autonomous from us, we could not survive. So we are the hosts for many other intelligences besides the human. And it seems like she had a great fascination with this, which makes sense because the book that I have read of hers, which is about a vampire who's lived over thousands of years, vampiring other people, basically taking over their nervous system and their organism. And then he uses it and then drops it. Male or female organisms. This particular vampire can inhabit. And I thought, well, that's really fascinating, that relationship between the vampire and this biological theory of Gaia and the whole idea of symbionts, and that creatures live off of other creatures' excrement, and how those ecological systems work seems to be of a great fascination for Octavia Butler. And it's wondrous to me how she drew from that, from her reading, to create these very unique and visionary works of fiction.
But it's interesting also because I haven't read a lot of Butler, but I was reading the biography that I put on the reference on the site. And one of the comments they make is that Butler takes the Gaia hypothesis and turns it on its tail, as she does with a lot of these ideas.
In the
book that she didn't finish, which is the sequel to Parable of the Talents, called Parable of the Trickster, that she didn't finish. They go to other worlds, but the other worlds' Gaias resist the arrival of humans and reject them. So it's the Gaia hypothesis, instead of being a positive thing, it becomes another challenge to deal with in terms of humans arriving in these worlds. So it's also a very interesting. But unfortunately, that was one of the books that she didn't finish, although I think there are references to those ideas in some of her other works. So. Maybe we're still waiting for a couple of people, but I think, because I know Mary was coming, but since we know everybody here, maybe we don't need intros, but we could say a little bit about why we're drawn to reading Butler, maybe just a little bit of an intro that way.
I think I already have.
I think you already have.
Oh, I haven't thought about this at all. I like good stories, for one, and I think she is from what I've read, and again, I've read Kindred, or at least parts of Kindred, and another book called Dawn. Dawn is a very interesting book as well, because it takes place after a nuclear holocaust on Earth, and the main character wakes up in a spaceship. You know, aliens have been witnessing what human beings have been doing, and these aliens are they're like professional intergalactic genetic traders, and so they use their own bodies to acquire and put to use new kinds of genetics that they find across, you know, across the universe. She has this way, I think, of introducing very interesting and thought-provoking and like very eerily, potentially realistic ideas into her work. And I think in addition to that, like, I'm drawn to reading works by African-American authors and female science fiction authors. I'm drawn to diversifying and to exploring other lineages of the genres, or of the mix of genres. She didn't really necessarily identify as a science fiction author. I mean, she just called herself a writer. And I think, that's the level at which I want to read her. And so I started reading the book, and I'm having this experience where it's not at all, doesn't at all feel labored. It feels very natural to read, and I want to read it like before bed. It kind of puts me in a dreamlike imaginative, I guess, state of mind. And so I'm looking forward to reading along and participating when I can in the live calls.
Yes. Going off the dream reference there, that's a focus in my life right now. And it seems that whenever I have a focus, all readings accumulate, all aspects of life bring in that focus. Or so if I learn a new word, I'll happen to see it in another portion of my reading. But the first thing I noticed about Octavia Butler, which I've heard the name, I hadn't read anything, checked out some of the biography material that Jeffrey posted there. But right after the posting on YouTube, I was led to, audiobook recording of Kindred, the first chapter, just as a lead-in to, like, you like this, you can purchase it type thing. But it was a dream sequence, but it was very real, and it was after I had listened to it, I can't remember if it started out as not a dream and then it went into a dream, or she was stepping out of it. So I feel like Octavia Butler was a dreamer in a lot of sense. She got her material from her dreams, which I don't know if that's in the biography or not, but the parable of the sower starts out with a dream. I've read the first couple chapters, but in the parable of the sower, it's almost as if that's foreshadowing what's going to come into the future. So I don't want to go into all that just yet, because I don't know much about it, but I like her. She's natural. She has a natural talent for this. And some of the themes that are popping up, which we've just noted here, are the theme of the body. And that's one of the things I've been working on too. I'm not my body. I'm not who you see right now. This is not truly who I am. And I feel like she is able to bring that out in a certain way, on a cosmic scale, or even with her main character. I can already tell that, well, she is her body in a lot of ways, but at the same time, she's not her body. I don't know, but I'm definitely attracted to her writing style and what I've glimpsed into her life and all that good stuff. So have you received your book yet, Donna? Is it arrived by mail?
Yes, I received both of them. Yeah, they're
congratulations.
Here. Thank you. Yeah, I didn't expect them to arrive that soon, actually. I've started reading Parable of the Sower. So far, I haven't heard about her before. I liked the book. I felt it's a very smooth reading. I like her style of writing. I'm still getting into the universe she's building, and I like the idea she's writing from a child perspective. I think the narrator is maybe 13, 14, something like that, 15, I'm not sure actually. And I feel myself like, yes, like the narrator, I'm trying to discover her and discover this universe she's building, trying to imagine the places, the people she's describing, how they look, this world she is building. It's very, so far for me, it's very interesting. I'm in chapter 4, and I mean, so far I like it. I like her language. I like her style of writing. Yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting book.
Great. So I thought what I'd do is give a little bit of the background of her life, as I've called it, from the bibliographical material that I've read over the last couple of weeks, just to give a bit of background of who she was as a person and what kind of a writer, how her life informed her writing, I guess, is partly what I wanted to get at. So she was born in 1947. She was raised in, I mean, poverty in the modern sense. I mean, a black family with not a lot of money. I think the father died very young, and so she was raised by her mother and grandmother. And when she talks in her interviews about her family, the role of women as people who take charge and who make sacrifices for the family is something she comes back on in her comments about her life. And you see it in the writing too, that often the women characters in her books seem to be the ones who step forward and take charge, and the men characters, they do too, but the story is different for the men characters. She had the chance of encountering Harlan Ellison, right, who just died a few weeks ago, I think. Who was running? He was organizing the first Clarion Writers Workshop. So those who've done any writing in science fiction, the Clarion Workshop is a reference for science fiction writers in training. It's been around since 1969, more or less. 1970, I think, was the first one, or 69, I'm not sure. But it's still running today, and it trains every year a group of writers in and around science fiction. So she attended the first Clarion Writers Workshop. And through that connection, she met other writers who became, in some cases, lifelong friends. So she met Samuel Delaney, who was a teacher at that first Clarion Workshop. And she met another science fiction writer who's quite well known called Vonda McIntyre. and some other writers like that. But so it was a key point for her because she'd been struggling to sell short stories, not having a lot of success with it. And her encounter with Harlan Ellison, who really strongly encouraged her to write and to push forward with her work, clearly made a big difference in terms of her writing career. Even though the plan was to include one of her stories that she had submitted to him in his final volume of Dangerous Visions. So it was called, going to be called Last Dangerous Visions, but the volume never appeared. And so her story stayed stuck in limbo for 10, 15 years and never saw the light of day. So she actually had some ambiguous feelings about her relationship with Ellison as a result of this kind of difficulty. She switched to novel writing. So she tried the short story and she did sell a couple of them, but they were difficult. It was difficult and it never paid very much money for the short stories. So in 1974, she decided she needed to switch out her writing and try other things. She tried some contemporary fiction, which didn't work out very well either. And then she went to novel writing with the idea that she could make a little bit more money in order to survive. And that was where her whole writing career started to take off. So when she sold Pattern Master, it became fairly quickly a reference for the milieu. And from there, her popularity started to grow. So 1974 to 1984 was the Pattern Master trilogy. 1985 to 1992 was a trilogy that they tend to call Xenogenesis. But they're both in the same universe, which is a kind of, it's a very dark understanding of the future. It's about power games between people with psychic powers and people without psychic powers, and the people with psychic powers win. And so the people without psychic powers have very little power in this kind of context. So, it plays with these contrasting paradoxes that she does. So in the beginning, the people with psychic powers are the ones who are seen as progressives. But later on, as they gain power, they are then viewed as the bad ones. And so she switches the allegiance or the understanding of who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. In fact, she has a comment about that at some point. She says she doesn't agree with that kind of analysis of books, that she's not interested in good guys and bad guys. Parable of the Sower was published in 1993, and Parable of the Talents was published in 1998. And they are the first two books of a new universe. So the other books, so she broke with the earlier books, which all followed a particular world-building universe context, and started an entirely new series, which is what these two books are. So in a sense, we get a fresh look at world building with Butler as a mature writer, as opposed to the long series that she'd been developing up to that point. And in some ways, the parable books are a little bit more optimistic in some ways than the earlier books. She's become more aware, more tolerant of difficulties and the sort of tensions in humanity. And there's some sense where these books are a little bit more aware of that, of those issues compared to the earlier books. And again, I'm speaking more or less through the writer of the biography, although I try to not take his word for the absolute. There's not a lot of biographical material on her except Wikipedia. His is the only full book I could find in an accessible way that gives a history of her life. And most of his book is about his her books rather than about her life per se. 1999 to 2006, so after the publication of Parable of the Talents, she was working on several new books, including, as I mentioned earlier, this Parable of the Trickster, which was going to be the third volume of the parables story. In 2006, she died suddenly of a stroke. And so it was a big shock to everybody, because nobody expected, and you know, and she'd written about expecting to live until she was 70 or more. So she died at 58. So when she died, she'd written 12 novels and 9 short stories that were all published. Now, one of the interesting things about her life is that, and her writing, is that she had dozens of alternate versions of the published books in her notes. She rewrote and rewrote the books with many different endings, with many different organizations of the books. And so what actually got published is, in a way, a fraction of the material that deals with each of the stories. And why she rewrote and did all this work. So a lot of the alternate stories are darker than the ones she published. She had a struggle in herself with the way the stories got recounted and what would be acceptable to the public and what would not be, and all of those issues. And so she had a lot of built-in paradoxes and contradictions. She was somebody who felt, even late in her life, profoundly unworthy. And she maintained a constant process of self-affirmation in order to counteract the feelings of being unworthy, which she developed into a kind of a litany of expressions and thoughts. She wrote in a diary as well. And in some ways, these litanies of self-affirmations in a kind of transformed way have become the poetry that we read in Parable of the Sower. The texts about God and all that are kind of a rewriting of some of her own, or at least they adopt some of the forms of her writing, self-writing about herself and the affirmations that she makes to herself or made to herself. She had a constant struggle with the editors because she didn't like her books to be meddled with by editors. And she also felt that she was being underpaid for her work. And so I think in one of the interviews, Johnny, you might have heard that she talks about the fact that when, with Parable of the Sower, she picked a small publishing unit to do Parable of the Sower because she didn't like the relationship that the big publishing houses had with a writer such as herself. And she found that the smaller publishing house were much more collaborative and personal in the relationship. So she was also somebody who she didn't have, I mean, who knows whether she had lovers, but she didn't have a husband. She was largely isolated for most of her life. She felt she was lonely, and she expressed that loneliness on many occasions. So Doug, you were talking about the body sense. Octavia Butler felt she was too big as a person. And that was part of her sense of unworthiness, that she saw herself as being bodily the wrong shape, and that was part of her need to reaffirm herself, and that may come into these issues around body in some of the works. She was convinced from a very early age, like as early as 9, that she was going to become a writer. But she had huge opposition to it. So I think she tells a story that her grandmother told her that Negroes can't be writers when she was 13. So she, you know, her mother and her grandmother discouraged her from doing any efforts in the writing direction. And she said, no, this is what I'm going to do. And she was adamant about it and went forward with it. She was also rejected any tendency to adopt either or positions. And that's so she didn't like black or white things. She wanted to work in the tones of gray, and she wanted to flip-flop things all the time. So she avoided, and she got into trouble with it. She got into trouble with the black liberation movements because she would write in such a way that they felt she was undermining some of their approaches. She also got in trouble with the feminist movement because she underwrote some things that were in the, you know, so she didn't, she stayed away from all of those organized movements because she didn't like the way the politics tended to get polarized, and her writing reflects that. I just wanted to finish up with a few quotes, some from her and some from the biographer. So the biographer writes, she stood for decades as science fiction's sole prominent black female voice, broadening the outlook of the field in ways that are still being felt today. She sometimes told the story of the white editor who didn't think that black should be included in science fiction stories because they changed the character of the stories. You could use an alien instead and get rid of all this messiness and all these people that we don't want to deal with. That was the comment of the editor, which enraged her, obviously. After Butler, this level of arrogant dismissal would be unthinkable in science fiction, or almost unthinkable. Her novels, like those of Samuel Delaney, Ursula Le Guin, Joanna Russ, and James Tiptree, who also known as real name was Alice Sheldon, other titans of the field with whom she is commonly paired, are all corrections of that fundamental error, the recovery of the nightmare of history whose memory has been erased from the everyday life of the privileged. Writer and musician Greg Tate said about her, well, about in general, that black people live the estrangement that science fiction writers imagine. So that's kind of part of what she's writing about. Butler's science fiction typically pit power against justice and leave both utterly transformed. These are stories born from her own subaltern position in American society. I began writing about power, she once told someone, because I had so little. And then a personal comment, her books are often characterized as presenting a bleak vision of humanity. And although there is truth in that idea, I found that the book has a profoundly human and highly nuanced portrait that belies the bleakness underneath it. That there's something very, very personal and idiosyncratic about her characters that counters the bleakness of the background in a sense, or that confronts it in a different way, something like that. Anyway, that's a personal thing. I read Clay's Ark, I think, which was another, but it probably wasn't the best book of Butler to read because it was part of a series and read out of context of the rest of the series, it wouldn't necessarily give a full sense of what she was about. I remember reading it and being perturbed and touched by it, but I didn't take it further and read anything more of her at the time. So I sort of come to it now with a recognition that I kind of missed the boat on the first time I read her, and that now it's, and obviously I'm drawn to these books because they're about the creation of a religion. And that's part of what I'm writing about in my books. So I find that particularly interesting as a general context. But I'm, like Donna, thoroughly enjoying the books and the writing as well. So, so I'm open to comments or thoughts.
So you said you were open to, or you came to the book because it relates to what you're writing about. Is that the only way you came to the book, or how did you find out that it was kind of parallels what you're writing about?
Well, I think I'm also drawn, like Marco, she's a voice for, you know, I'm white and I'm male, but that doesn't mean I'm not interested in stories about people who have other cultural backgrounds and other genders. So as one voice for, and one very strong voice for alternate understandings of the world, that's certainly part of what draws me to her writing. Mm.
I was surprised at how little there is on her. I expected to find documentaries and, I don't know, TV episodes and things like that, just because she's such a prominent kind of figure, I think, in the, at least from my perception, in the world of science fiction. And there was really quite very little that I found anyway through Googling and scrolling through multiple pages and looking at multiple videos. I did see the interview with Charlie Rose, and that was okay. And there was maybe two other interviews that I was able to find, kind of low quality, not very well produced. I mean, interesting content, but not, you know, not given the, I think, attention or the resources that it would deserve.
And there was one I didn't put up, which was very critical of her. I don't know if you saw that one. It was actually, it was back to back with the Charlie Rose interview, but it was another interview. I can't remember the name of the person, but they were highly critical of her, you know, pushing hard, difficult and negative questions towards her. And it was a uncomfortable interview to listen to.
Hmm. One thing that surprised me was, I'm looking for the right word, but just the actuality of her personal economic predicament. In a couple of the interviews, she talks about buying a house. This is something that she aspired to. This is something she wanted to do for a big part of her life, it seems. And just after Parable of the Talents was published, she gained some success and was finally able to do that. And she also talks about the many different kinds of jobs she did, jobs involving, you know, hard manual labor, like, you know, difficult situations. Like, she did a lot of different things to get by and to you know, pursue her craft as a writer. Also her habits, waking up very early in the morning. She said she would wake up at 2 a.m. during the time when she was working that much to get her writing done, and then how miserable she would be. I know just what this is like, but how miserable she would be at work because she hadn't gotten enough rest or sleep. And how that continued, maybe this ties back to, you know, that self-worth thing that you were talking about, Jeffrey. Even after she gained success, she was still, you know, keeping to that kind of schedule. So it struck me just how normal, average, those desires were, to have a place to live, to not have to work your ass off, you know, just to get by. She received a MacArthur fellowship as well, I think, after Parable of the Talents, I believe, which is a significant prize, hundreds of thousands of dollars, I think, and not officially, but it's called the Genius Grant. And very, you know, this is one of the highest awards and recognitions that one can get in the United States for the arts. So that seemed to have helped as well. And the other bit I got from the material I viewed was the body thing, feeling big and kind of awkward around other people who are all smaller than her. Her bearing it's a kind of robust presence or a robust bearing, I think. A lot of strength I feel in the physical transmission, just from what one could see in the video. I wonder if I think that's interesting to be able to inhabit a kind of strength or a kind of stability of one's awareness or one's presence. I think there's something like that going on, almost a fear of how strong one might be. It's just some initial thoughts based on my internet research before reading this.
Well, I suspect it's... So go ahead, John.
Oh, I'm sorry. I saw an interview, and I'll post it if I can find it. It was a panel discussion, and Samuel Delaney was on the panel. It seemed like to be shortly after her death, so a lot of people were reminiscing about her. And I think he had some very sensitive observations to make about her personality and her incredible shyness. I think you mentioned that he was one of her instructors in one of these. And she was very shy and sort of tormented about presenting her stuff. But he did note that over her career, she matured a great deal and came into her power. And he remarked that he would sometimes show up at science fiction conferences, and the fans that would line up to get an autograph from Octavia Butler was much longer than the line that they queued up to get an autograph from him. So it looked like she had quite surpassed him in some ways, which he was actually delighted by. And I think Samuel Delaney and Octavia Butler, I'm a very attracted to. Certainly Delaney, I know him better. And I know him from his memoirs from the 40s and the 50s. He was, of course, black. He was gay. But he also married a lesbian and fathered a daughter. So he had a very complex and ambiguous erotic nature, which he wrote about quite a bit in his fiction. And I saw him, and she seems to be someone who didn't, she seems to me coming out of an outsider kind of art, maybe underground. And she became, you know, a major figure in her field. And I think that kind of her ambiguity around certain issues about her own erotic nature, she put in her books, I think. And I think that that she did not align herself with any particular group, probably because she resisted the whole idea of labeling, of getting labeled and then dismissed. I think that's a pattern, I think, that's very interesting among a lot of those who've been outsiders. And once they become insiders, they sort of long to be outsiders again because they don't fit comfortably in anyone's pre-given slot. So I think that's what I find very attractive about her. Also, I really wish that there had been better interviewers around her. I haven't seen the contentious interview that someone's mentioned, but I thought the Charlie Rose interview was just a terrible missed opportunity. When she was talking about listening to a podcast or listening to the Teaching Company, which is a, I've listened to a lot of those Teaching Company courses myself in the commutes that I've done. You know, I'm in a train for a long time getting to work, and I would just put on one of these podcasts. And I thought it was really sort of, I felt when she talked about listening to a podcast on Hegel and how it just, and she thought it was important to be listening rather than reading, but to listen to a voice talking about something took her to somewhere else. And I just wished Charlie had said, is there anything else about that somewhere else that it took you to? And when listening to Hegel, is there anything else about Hegel? Because that to me would be so much more interesting than an interesting direction to create conditions for such a great mind like hers. Unfortunately, you know, Charlie Rose and most of the mainstream interviewers really dumb it down as much as possible. Anyway, that's sort of my pet peeve is, you know, when these interviewers, when they have a spectacularly gifted artist, they just ask the dumbest things in the world. They ask the dumbest things of politicians as well. So I'm hoping, you know, we can create the conditions in our gatherings like this to start asking much more interesting questions than I think what the mainstream literati are focused on. So thank you for listening to my rant.
But it's interesting that you talk about the erotic aspects, because that's, again, that's one of the things that the biographer talked about as well. She certainly had a strong erotic component to her being and to her writing. She also, one thing that I didn't mention that the biographer mentions quite extensively is the fact that she read from a very early age comic books, and she collected them later on in her life as well. And that in a lot of ways, the stories that she writes are informed by the stories that are in comic books. So the Superman, sort of Batman kind of storyline is somehow behind some of the story. And certainly there's an erotic component to Superman, Batman, and these kinds of things that is also present in the writing. I just got a message from Mary saying that she thought the meeting was at 2. She got confused about the timing because you remember the timing now corrects automatically, but people assume that it's the mountain time. And so she thought the 12 o'clock that she was looking was 2. So so she may join us in a few minutes if she gets back from her errand in time. So anyway.
Just another point I wanted to make, something that, referring to something that Douglas said about dreaming and the liminal zones, and also about the body and the ambiguity about the body. And, you know, what someone sees from the outside is not the way you are on the inside. So there's always this miscommunication that seems to be happening between people when they try to find language to make contact with others about these interiors. And I was thinking of Manning because some of us have recently finished studying one of her books. And I thought that big question about what can a body do that Manning asks, I think this is something that we could ask of ourselves too when we read Butler. Because I think she's very interested in what a body can do, and the paranormal side of her her imagination, and like you mentioned earlier, this sort of tug of war, power struggle that occurs between those who have these paranormal capacities and those who don't, and how initially that can be a positive thing that those who have paranormal abilities win, but then they also can become oppressors, because they can misuse their paranormal capacities. So I think that's another thing that some of us have been exploring about the ethical side of these paranormal capacities, which I believe we all have. We all have a psychic capacity, but some of it has been suppressed by our educations and our experiences. And I believe that this probably happened to Octavia Butler as well. So I just think it's that's another theme that is of great interest to me. What a body can do. Big research question.
Thanks. So the biographer noted that when she first started writing the stories about the paranormal, it was the 1970s. In the 1970s, the paranormal was widely accepted as being a part of the human experience. But by the 1990s, when she was publishing later on, the sort of interest in the paranormal had dropped dramatically. And so she found her own ideas were received very differently than they were originally. And so there'd been an evolution. And in fact, Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents, they have this empathic ability that is in them, but it's not exactly paranormal in the classical sense of paranormal. So she's modulated the way she works with the paranormal to make it more palatable to a 1990s audience as opposed to the 1970s audience, I think.
I think though that I think she was very comfortable with the apperspectival. She would go into science and she would speculate along with Einstein, theory of relativity and quantum mechanics, and she would craft these stories of characters who got caught up in a different time. And they got information perhaps from that different time. And then they got landed into a current sort of American urban decay kind of landscape with these awarenesses of the times and places and that kind of disorientation that it creates. So I think she was very aware of the like a pseudo orientation in time. She could fast forward into the future and see all kinds of patterns, and then she would be going back into a regressed state from a previous time. But she somehow managed to maintain connection with those future memories. So I think that's another fascination. I think that's probably pretty widespread in science fiction, but I think she was able to go from, you know, a kind of scientific, she seemed to maximize these intensities in some of the scientific discourse of her time. And she probably did have to modulate the affects in her stories so that she could stay in contact with an audience. That was definitely, as you mentioned, shifting from the 70s, which was the paranormal, and in the 80s, New Age really kicked in. And then there was a real shutdown that happened in the 90s. And I remember that very vividly, the openness of the 70s and the 80s, and then the complete sort of harsh shutdown that happened around those kinds of topics, which I don't think we've quite recovered from, but maybe we will. Thanks.
Hello. Is that Katina? Maybe she has a problem with her sound. I don't know. Marco, you're muted.
I was trying to chatter.
Okay.
Well, maybe she'll try again.
So I wonder, Donna, if you could say a few more words about what you liked about her writing style, and because I think it is interesting what she's doing with language.
Yes, actually, I felt as if I am like an archaeologist, you know, every chapter like a tablet, and I'm, you know, reading this tablet with wonder. Every chapter is taking me to deeper and deeper to discover this universe she's creating. And, you know, this, she writes at the beginning of each chapter, like these words, as if you feel verses. And I mean, for me, very interesting style, very interesting language, writing from a point of view of a child, but at the same time, you feel this child is going back to childhood, and as if a grown-up is writing now, trying to discover, relate to understand her being as a child in this universe, her relation with his, with her father, her siblings, even to understand the environment she's in. I felt that everybody are fine with the environment except this person, and feeling she's strange. I don't know. She gave me that sense, actually. But the chapters were very easy to read, very beautiful. I didn't suffer reading them. I just kept reading on and on. I'm so excited. I mean, when I saw the schedule saying from chapter 1 to 8, I was like, will I be able to finish it? But now I think, yeah, I think I will. And there is something about her writings. I don't know. It's not, I like the idea that she didn't like labeling. It's not that she's a woman or she's a man or African-American, but her writings are really, I mean, for me, from a different culture, I just felt, wow, I like how she writes. I'm enjoying her book, you know?
Because I found her writing very simple.
Yes, that's true.
In a way that is charming, in a way, you know, that yes, takes you into it.
Yes. You feel it's simple, but at the same time, you feel there is something in the language. She's very, the language is becoming very flexible for her, you know? It's a tool. She knows her tool. She writes, I mean, the sentences, how she describes things. Sometimes some people, they describe, you know, you read a book and you feel like this is too much or this is not enough. Every chapter, I felt, yes, she's writing perfectly, describing and taking me, you know, smoothly into this world and making me feel, yes, I want to know more and learn more, and making me feel what's going to happen next. And at the same time, I feel there is something much bigger is coming up in the coming chapters. This is the feeling that I have.
Mary, do you want to introduce yourself? You'll need to unmute yourself first.
There I am. Hi, everyone, and sorry for being late. I wrote down the wrong time. I was missing the 1, 2 for 12, and I wrote down 2. So my name's Mary. I don't know what you did for introductions earlier. Should I just tell
you? You should introduce yourself, because the five of us know each other from other chats, so we didn't do much of an intro.
Okay.
But since you're new, you should probably introduce yourself a little bit more. And then we talked about why we're drawn to Butler's work.
Oh, all right. Well, so my name's Mary. My background is as a scientist, an oceanographer and a biologist. Although I'm currently doing much more work in arts and literature. I do a lot of writing, writing fiction. And in fact, that's how I know Jeffrey. Jeffrey and I both live in the same city. So we've been writing buddies for a while now. And he was the one who told me that this discussion group was going on. I love science fiction. I've read it since I was 10 and stealing them from my brother's room to read under the covers. And I've always wanted to read Octavia Butler. I have to say, I haven't read any of her books yet. But I knew of her reputation as sort of this game changer in science fiction, that she had transformed what was going on. And so this seemed like a great opportunity to finally dive in and have a group of people to talk to about it. How's that?
That's good.
Okay. Nice to meet you all. I'm looking forward to getting to know you. I should say I'm here for this session, and then I actually have to go do some field work, some of my science field work. So I will miss your discussions of Parable of the Sower, and I'll be rejoining you for Parable of the Talents in 3 or 4 weeks. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. It's nice to meet you. Welcome.
Thanks.
Jeffrey, is it just as a point of order, are you intending this session to be more of an overview of Octavia's work and our approaches to it, or is it okay, as far as spoilers or what have you, to talk a little bit about the text of this book itself? Like, where are we in the schedule?
Well, maybe we could just share how much we read of the books, if at all, and then you know, as my department director used to say, the group is sovereign. So, you know, we manage our own discussions, and if we decide to go into the discussion of the first book now, we can decide that as a group, you know, so.
Should we vote on that, or how would we? So,
we have to get approval from John, who prefers not.
Let me clarify something that I'm a little confused about myself. Anyone who's on this call can say anything they want to about this text, except I would appreciate it if we don't go into third-person critical accounts of evaluating this text, which we've not read. If we've not read the text, and we want to bring in a critic who's criticizing the text, I object to that, because I don't want to know what Joe Schmo thinks about something that I've not read yet. You know, I would just ask people to press pause before they go to outside of our group to locate some evaluations of this text. We've done that to some extent, it's fine, but I don't mind anybody skipping ahead and mentioning a plot change, and I may not have read it yet. That's okay with me too. I think she knows this, anticipatory creatures. Mm. We anticipate the future constantly, and sometimes we get it wrong, and sometimes we're remarkably accurate because we're very good at guessing things. So I think that's fascinating. If someone wants to report on something that was significant to them about the story, and they're ahead of me and I haven't got there yet, that's fine. But I just find myself cringing when someone sort of interrupts this process by saying, well, so-and-so evaluated this coming chapter, which you've not read, in such a way. So it's already been pre-framed in a way that now I can't escape that pre-framing. So I hope that's a clear objection without, of course, inhibiting anyone else's learning curve here. For whatever purpose you want to use this text, it's great. But I'm just saying that will get me to resist.
Limit our comments to the first 4 chapters and then leave it open to the next time to go into it deeper for some of the reasons that Johnny is talking about.
And after we've read this text, I think we could bring in third person, you know, whoever thinks anything about this text, we can refer to them, you know, and share that, because now we're able to evaluate their evaluations and it won't interrupt the flow of your own imaginal exploration of the text. So thanks.
I would say that I was kind of interested by the fact that I broke the text up literally by chapters, you know, first 8 chapters, second 8 chapters, third 8 chapters. But when I read through the different sections, I actually found that they're actually a good division. In a way, they are. The book almost breaks up into those three pieces. So it wasn't such a bad, you know, I thought it was a bit arbitrary at the time, but it wasn't such a bad approach.
Well, I wouldn't mind then. First, thank you to John for the clarification, because it's not about plot spoilers or that kind of a thing. And I think you're right on.
That doesn't bother me at all. I like that, actually, because then when I get to it, I'll say, oh, this is what he or she thought about this. Now I'm there. So that's good, creates community, I think.
Okay. With that said, then I would like to highlight a couple of the themes that I'm noticing and I'm attracted to and interested in these first few chapters, given that I don't know what happens later. I don't know how this ends or where it goes. But I mean, one, I think it's good that we have Donna here, because in a way it gives us, and I think, you know, more so than even just the, you know, being Canadian, you, Jeffrey, and Mary being Canadians, I think it gives a way to take a different perspective on the United States of America, because this story seems to be unfolding in a future state of the United States of America, some kind of degeneration, some kind of loss of social cohesion and control, and an extrapolation, one could say, of current trends, at least one way of looking at them. Just to bring in not an evaluation, but another perspective, somebody called Octavia Butler a master of extrapolation, and made the link between her reading, her scientific and social, political, and economic studies, and her philosophical studies, and the kinds of ideas that she extrapolates in the text. If current trends continue, if these phenomena or dynamics or patterns play themselves out, what does the world look like in a few years down the road? And so this book now is being set in 2024, going into 2025. And the feeling that I have as a resident and citizen of the United States, and in this time of Trump and of, you know, an obvious worsening of inequalities and an acceleration of a certain process of division and discord, it feels very realistic. It feels like this is completely plausible way that things could look in certain parts, at least, of this country, even within the time frame that is being described. And I think famously in Parable of the Talents, there's a presidential candidate who is running on the slogan of making America great. So there's almost a prophetic quality perhaps to this text. Those are the things that, some of the couple of things that stand out for me in these first few pages. And I'll pause to hopefully try to welcome Katina. Could you hear us? Could you hear me?
Okay.
Try going to the Zoom preferences and check your audio set there. Testing.
Yeah, I can hear you now.
All right.
Oh, good.
We can hear you.
Great.
So, would you like to introduce yourself, Katina?
My name's Katina, and I just learned about Infinite Conversations probably
about a week ago. I was actually looking for some information on the book by Gebser, Ever-Present Origin, and I found, and so I sort of stumbled across Infinite Conversations. Okay, so I'm in my 40s, and by profession, special education teacher, but I'm not in a classroom right now. I actually teach online. What else? Let's see. Okay, yeah, I'm from Virginia. I went to William & Mary as an undergrad and studied philosophy and religion until I got my BA in, and then went to graduate school at OBU in Virginia, Old Dominion University, and got my master's in education. And I just love reading. So.
And are you familiar with Octavia Butler's work from before, or have you read some of her books before?
Yes, the parable series, The Sower, The Talents, and I think there was another one that I read by her. I read the one I was in jail. So they were really, I was in jail for some time, for like maybe 4 months for a DUI, and my friend sent me some of her books, and that's when where I really got into them. So, and I love science fiction. Well, so. Yeah, I'm familiar with Octavia Butler.
Great.
I think you're in the right place.
Okay.
So, what's the connection?
You're not the only one who's been in jail, by the way.
We know about how we're in the age of transparency now. So I just tell people, where I'm coming from. And I like the fact that I've been able to experience. I like the fact that I had that experience, because it really sort of broadened. Well, it gave me more compassion for people that are in jail and that are incarcerated. And it's just something I said that I guess it's something that I can say that I've done before.
So. What's the connection with Gebser?
Because I was looking. I just recently started reading him, and so I was just looking for. This is how I found Infinite Conversations. I was just searching online for some, just some information about his work, Ever Present Origin, and I saw, and then I think something came up with Infinite Conversations about a reading room or what have you. And then, so when I went into Infinite Conversations looking for something on Gebser, I found that there was, it sort of opened up this like Pandora's box of all of these different conversations. And I'm like, whoa, I've been looking, it's like an online Parthenon or something. So I'm like, wow, where has this place been all my life?
That's cool. We did a reading group on Gebser's Ever-Present Origin in winter of 2016. And
Winter Origins.
Yeah, that's right. So we did about 16 sessions on that book. There's a ton of material, and a number of other people, participants on the website, who have read or are reading Ever-Present Origin. And we've read fiction, poetry, philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We have some scientists here, so we've dipped our toes into quantum physics and things like that. So this is a community of readers and talkers, I guess. And you're very welcome here. Thank you for showing up.
And some of us missed out on the Gebser reading, so I've started reading Gebser. So I've read about 100 pages of him yet so far, but so we're probably maybe roughly the same level of reading of Gebser on the book. Well, maybe you're further along, but it would be fun to exchange insights on that as we go too.
Yeah, I've actually been using Winter Origins as like a study guide as I moved through it once I found it on your website. And I was one of the things I'm really amazed about. I don't know who put together Infinite Conversations, but it's really well put together, it's well organized, and I noticed that there's a lot of intertextuality. You know, and I don't know if this is on purpose or if this is just coincidence, because right after I came out of Winter Origins and reading some of the conversations or discussion you all had on that book, then I went into a reading room or something and found this wonderful article on AI, on the singularity. And right away there was like, it was almost, I don't know whoever wrote the article on the singularity, it tied in so much with some of the discussion I read about on Gebser, on ever-present origin. I mean, Gebser, I think, was kind of prophetic in a way when he talked about this particular stage of human consciousness. And I think that Octavia Butler would probably have something to say, especially in terms of the setting of her parable books. It seems like the setting of her science fiction with, I think one of her themes was one of her themes had to do with like, it was Earthseed, about creating a new race among the stars or something like that. And I just think that it's just interesting how the setting of her book probably has a lot to do with, it relates to what Gebser predicted would be the sort of the next stage of human, of evolution with human consciousness, that, you know, we would get to that point where we could reach out beyond, I guess, be more comfortable with otherness. It would be interesting to see how, I don't know, I just think that Gebser in general, that's what attracted me to his book, is because a lot of what he writes, especially this particular stage of human consciousness, he didn't write this when we had the internet and when we had advanced technology, and yet it ties right in. So I just think that's kind of neat.
Right. Marco was just talking about the fact that the book starts out with a sort of U.S. in the process of falling apart, essentially, and present on this conversation. So Mary and myself are both Canadians, and Donna is present from Jordan. So we have several non-American presences in the virtual room, if you like. So we were talking about the fact that that gives us somewhat different, possibly a somewhat different perspective on the book.
Well, I think the very last thing I was saying before you hopped on, Katina, was that there's a prophetic, potentially prophetic, you know, quality. And I mentioned that bit that there's a presidential candidate character later on who wants to make America great. And And this is only a few years out, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of within the time zone. So it's weird in that way. And, you know, she didn't have Google either. So this was purely from imagination and from, I was just saying, extrapolation, like from, mm-hmm. She was a voracious reader apparently as well in the sciences, psychology, economics, sociology. And just, you know, one other thing that just comes to mind about her reading is that she reads slowly and she pays attention to the words and pays attention to their sound. And so there's also like the feeling, there's almost it's not just that the events are prophetic, but there's a kind of feeling anticipation of what things might feel like living in like these kinds of conditions. And so that's just where I think the conversation comes back to. We talked a bit about more generally some research that we've done looking at old interviews and some of the biographical material. This video, we record these, as you know, and we'll post it so you can catch up and watch the beginning of it if you wish to. That's all I wanted to highlight at first, is how plausible the whole scenario feels.
And also, I just want to point out, the biggest designer here is Marco of the Infinite Conversations.
He's oh, wow. kind
of the maverick, and many of us have been attracted to what he was doing. Mm-hmm. So I just want to offer a, you know, an appreciation.
Thank you, Marco.
That, we're all creating the conditions for whatever wants to happen next. Mm-hmm. And our participation is, I think, going to be required of us. It's no one's going to do this for us. So right. I think figuring it out is a great challenge for all of us. So thank you for being here.
And your feedback.
Thanks for putting this together.
Your feedback was music to my ears too, because from the inside, it doesn't feel well organized at all. It feels kind of like, you know, this mess.
Great.
So to hear that you found it useful and that some of the things that we explicitly intended, like with the Gebser readings, we wanted people to be able to come like you have and to mm-hmm. follow along the reading and to get something from it and be able then to contribute to the intertextuality of the site as a whole. And so it's cool to hear that it's working.
Yeah, it is.
I just wanted to quickly note I'm over here in Kentucky, not too far from Virginia there, but I too found the site in November because of Gebser. So I don't know, perhaps if we, the three of us, Jeffrey as well, or if anybody wants to do a second reading group or even just spontaneously talk about it at some point outside of an Octavia Butler conversation, then I'd be willing to do that.
Dante, did you come to the group through Gebser too?
I just like Katina's saying, I was searching around, I heard an interview, but so that's how I found it just this past November.
I just want to note that Ed Mahut actually put together the curriculum for a course on Gebser. So we did a kind of week-by-week reading, but he organized it at, I think, a higher, like, synthetic or cineretic level. And that is yet to be produced, but there's a plan for it to form. And he'd, I think, be certainly interested in continuing that conversation.
I guess going off what you were saying, Marco, with the kind of prophetic voice, the first thing I picked up on, and there was one of the interviews, the interviewer asked, like, are you predicting the future? What do you see the future as? And she kind of laughs and says that that's a huge question. Or requires a huge answer, but she goes into the parable of the sower and the talents and said the walled community that these individuals are in, the main character and her family seems to be in a walled community, which I haven't read it, so I don't know too much about it, but it seems like they're venturing out into drug infested and chaos, sex, violence, whatever else is out there. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes. But in a way, there is this kind of walling. You can say it's the Trump's desire to build a wall, or going inside our homes and stuck in front of the computers or whatever it might be. But we're approaching that walled community. So I found that to be interesting.
I wanted to say, it's interesting, we're all using the word prophetic, and it reminds me of
You're back on mute, Mary. Sorry.
I'm sorry. How much of that did you get? I just want to say, we've been using the word prophetic. Get that mouse button away from that. And I actually teach Sunday school at my church. And when I'm teaching youth about the prophets of the Old Testament, I always tell them that prophetic is not a synonym of predictive, too. That it's we often use them interchangeably, but they're not exactly the same thing. And the purpose of a prophet isn't always to see the future, but it's something sort of richer than that. In a religious sense, I guess maybe you could say it's to tell you the mind of God, is to tell you about God. But then when we carry that into a secular realm, or a semi-secular realm, it's interesting to think, I guess my question is, what is prophecy for? It's not necessarily an obvious question to my mind. I'll leave that open.
I think that's a great question. I just wanted to, I think that we sometimes confuse the mythical with the scientific effort to predict and control. I think a lot of our contemporary science, which I think Gebser would say is in the deficient mode, because predict and control is a very narrow way of thinking about science. I think Gebser was wanting to create conditions for a science of qualities, rather than reducing science to just gathering data and numbers and crunching those numbers to produce a predictable product. And I think those two capacities in our nature to deal with the indeterminate and the unpredictable is where those religious movements come out of, and those mythic capacities we have to create, you know, stories that we can share. So I think that's a great question. Thank you for that.
I wanted to agree. That is a great question, Mary, when you talk about, when you remind us not to equate the prophetic with the predictable or predictive, because I studied Old Testament, like a New Testament literature, and in the theology of it. And when you ask about what's the role of a prophet, I know that from the historical point of view, or from the perspective of Judaism, the work of the prophet was, or the role of the prophet was to, like you said, communicate the voice of God. But I also think that the purpose of the prophet was to communicate truth as well. And because, you know, you had the law and the prophets, which sort of predated, the new covenant, God in Judaism, he depended on the prophets to, like you said, communicate his voice, but also to communicate truth. And so I guess when I say prophetic, when I talk about Gebser's ever-present origin, and even like I think Al said, Octavia Butler's the prophetic aspects of her fiction, I mean, in the sense that they are communicating truth that has sort of a universal quality to it, that's probably and what I meant by it was not so much like a time, like something that, predicting something that would happen in the future, but in that they were able to recognize the truths, these truths, and then to communicate them.
A warning, in fact, you know, a warning of what, a warning as much as a prediction is perhaps a good word for it. Yeah, I just remembered the theologian Walter Brueggemann, I think, said that the three roles of the prophet are to name what's going wrong, to denounce what's wrong with our world, to mourn for it, and to give hope. That those are the three parts of the prophetic voice. And that's maybe interesting in the context of fiction.
Yeah, and the first part, that's probably, I think, one of the most, that's where truth comes in, I think. When you said the first part, you know, to name what's going wrong, that's what I sort of identify as, you know, as communicating truth. Truth that a lot of times, I mean, and it was a very dangerous role as well, to communicate truth or what's going wrong to masses of people who maybe are out of touch. You know, I think that the role of the prophet, or the role, or when I say prophetic, it's something that can, you know, connecting us with reality, you know, connecting us with with things as they really are, not, you know, not subject to perspective all the time. But that's neat that you teach Sunday school. What age group?
Sorry, just a point on procedure. We stay muted unless we need to speak. Want to speak. Okay. So that's why I muted you earlier, Katrina.
Oh, thank you.
So it's just a way of managing the group. So go ahead with your question.
No, Paul. I was just going to say you asked what I teach. I'm lucky. I've got they've grown up now. They're all teenagers, and they're smart. I have great students, and we have conversations about these things. Adolescents can be so inquisitive about these deep questions. So it's been a really good environment for me. Yeah.
One other procedural point too, you can unmute yourself kind of to let others know that you have something to say. So like I'll see that John's unmuted or somebody else unmuted, then I'll kind of, leave a little space if they appear to, sometimes you can just tell by the way somebody looks like something's arising. But I just wanted to say that I think prophecy also is an intervention, and it's a saying of truth, but it's also in a way wants to change the future, I think, because there's motive behind the speaking. And I think that relates to this. I like to read something from the text, like bring in a piece of it, because we're getting into the theology, and this is the story of the birth of a religion, right? This is the character, Lauren is a kind of prophet, perhaps, and we're getting these insights into the formation of her teaching or of her views. And there's a diary entry, Saturday, August 17th, 2024, where she writes, for whatever it's worth, here's what I believe. It took me a lot of time to understand it, then a lot more time with a dictionary and a thesaurus to say it just right, just the way it has to be. In the past year, it's gone through 25 or 30 lumpy, incoherent rewrites. This is the right one, the true one. This is the one I keep coming back to. And then she goes on, this is kind of like poetically down the page. God is power. Infinite, irresistible, inexorable, indifferent. And yet, God is pliable, trickster, teacher, chaos, clay. God exists to be shaped. God is change. And then she goes on to say, this is the literal truth, and a bunch more about God. But I find that really compelling. I find that really powerful, actually. Like, this is a way of transmitting. I think it's more than literary. It is literary. It's like literary, and it's like transcendent, or it's maybe like integral expression. So anyway, I just wanted to bring the language itself into the space.
She opens it with all that you touch, you change. All that you change changes you. The only lasting truth is change. God is change. So in a way, we are also God. So that, I don't know how that's going to tie into the scheme of things there. That's pretty interesting as well.
I do feel that this idea that we shape God is perhaps what is the most surprising about her statements about God. I mean, we tend to think of God as being beyond our ability to influence. And so the idea that we would shape God as well as God shaping us, I think it fascinates me as an idea that's in this book.
It's also a very simple way of putting the whole evolutionary spirituality idea. Like, this is a more recent, I think, movement in philosophy or cosmology, the idea that human consciousness is, you know, it can co-create, it's kind of a buzzword, co-create the future. I think this idea that we shape God is saying the same thing, except much more simply.
I just wanted to suggest also, Mary, you quoted a theologian, and I'm not familiar with him, but I liked your quote. And if you want to use the forum to write something more about that or link to that material, I think that really creates all kinds of opportunities for us to learn from each other, you know, about how you're reading this text. And also, I've sort of used the forums to, you know, generate conversations around dreams that I've had or visionary episodes that I've had, you know, stuff that sometimes makes me feel very vulnerable to be talking about this in public. But I think this is a great opportunity for all of us to bring our, you know, the deviant side of our nature, the really weird and unusual stuff, as I believe Octavia Butler has done, you know, and she's found a way of communicating this to others. And I think this is a dilemma that many of us feel as we are trying to integrate our intuition with, you know, the facts on the ground and the limitations of perhaps these power structures, you know, these institutions which are pulling the strings and making us feel like puppets on a string. I think Octavia Butler is extremely sensitive to these invisible fields that are shaping our world and how we can, you know, create interventions, you know, at our, wherever we're at. I think it's a very creative opportunity for us. So maybe we can explore more of this in between calls, these conference calls in our forum. And I welcome all of you to use that forum. Thank you.
Well, I think it's also interesting that that, you know, like you were talking about how in Parable of the Sower, Octavia Butler creates this, you know, she sort of creates this new religion, Earth Seed. And it's interesting throughout the whole book, she, the author, kind of, she really deals with two main religions, you know, Earth Seed, and then she contrasts it, I think she contrasts it with Christianity. You could tell, and you can also tell that she probably doesn't have, it seems like in this dystopian type of society or setting, that Christianity as a religion has exhausted its, they've sort of exhausted its resources in terms of providing hope. And because you were talking about, you know, the prophetic, one of the roles of the prophet is to provide hope. Like that, the way Octavia Butler uses one of the major world religions, Christianity, and in the parable is to, it's almost like she's showing that that particular belief system wasn't sufficient to, what it proved to be insufficient in preventing how the world got to this state that it's in, and that it also is related to a lot of the growing corruption and control that the leaders in her book are trying to assume, you know, over society. And I think it's also interesting that, but while at the same time, she also, the very, very title of her parable series, in her parable series, you know, she uses a Judeo-Christian reference of the parables. You know, there's like over 50 parables in the Bible. And it's interesting that she connects, you know, the title of her book and probably some of the themes to the actual parable of the sower. I think it's one of the Gospels, Luke 8, or yeah, Luke, I think it's like Luke chapter 8 or something. And that particular parable the parable of the sower in the New Testament, it like vividly depicts the relationship between religion and man and humankind, right? When Christ, you know, told that parable, that was one of the, he was trying, I think one of the things he was revealing in that parable was, you know, the relationship between religion and humankind, and that whereas, you know, while the majority, although they've heard the truth, that a religion embodies, they'll prioritize other things before truth and forget. And then it turns out by the end of the parable, very few remain receptive to the message and actually consolidate their belief, you know, through action. And, you know, I just think it's interesting. As a Christian, I was a little bit uncomfortable with some of the things that the story saying about you know, the faith, that particular faith. But then again, it's obviously had some influence on her because she's named her, you know, she's named the whole series after that. And I'd like to look more into why she chose the Judeo-Christian, you know, like parables to communicate the themes, you know, in her science fiction. Whilst at the same time, when you read through the book, it looks like Christianity is not, is kind of frowned upon, and the effectiveness of Christianity is sort of diminished, you know, at this point in the future, you know. And so I don't know. I think that's something I'd like to explore it a little bit more. If anybody's comfortable with it, like why she, how this is related to the parables, and what do you think? What statements do you think she's saying? What is she saying about religion? Not religion, okay. But what is she saying? Because she does focus on these two religions, Earth Seed and then Christianity. And it seems like Christianity is almost the opposing faith. It's sort of like the faith of the antagonist in the story. And I'm just wondering like what she's saying, you know, if anyone has any other thoughts about what Octavia Butler's, what kind of statement she's making about faith, about, you know, Christianity or about Judeo-Christian religion. Because she does focus on that. You know, she doesn't bring in Buddhism. She doesn't bring in any other faiths that are, you know, world religions like Islam or, you know, she doesn't focus on any other Abrahamic faith. And what's interesting, too, is that while a lot of people in our modern society, we often, we always try to associate a certain faith with, when we try to blame a particular faith for the potential destruction of civility in society, we usually point to Islam. Okay, that's what our society does with, you know, the whole terrorism and fundamentalist faith-based destructive behavior. But it looks like Octavia Butler, she's saying that no, it seems like in her book that she's showing that Christianity had a lot to do with the breakdown of civilization.
So I'd suggest that maybe she's picked the faith of the establishment, mm-hmm. Because we know that no system of faith is in a vacuum. It's always mixed in with our politics and our economies and our way of life and very hard to disentangle. So here in Quebec, I'm an Anglican, which was for a century was almost the religion of the government. And because of that, it has been associated with some incredibly damaging policies, racist things that have happened, the suppression of Indigenous people and so on. And now we're going through a process of figuring out how to deal with that our church helped commit terrible crimes. And I have to admit I haven't gotten into the book yet, but I suspect that what's important here is that Octavia Butler is targeting the faith of the establishment, which in her context would be Christianity. And so, and you can't pull it apart, like I said. You can't say this is just the faith part of society, because it's got its tendrils. Inevitably, is impossible to unhook.
It's also the faith of her father, and this is a 15-year-old, you know, becoming woman, who is, you know, has different ideas about how society could be run or what the community needs. Like, I haven't read the whole book yet. I'm just to the point where she's starting to have very concrete differences of opinion with her dad about what the best course forward is for this community that's living, you know, kind of under his shepherdship or something, like he's their spiritual leader. And here she has some very different ideas about what would be, you know, what would be best.
Also, the book was published in 1992, and a lot of the Islamophobia came out after the World Trade incident. So it kind of precedes the mania that we've got about Islam right now. The other thing I wanted to mention is she does discuss Buddhism. It's not strong. I mean, it's mostly about Christianity, but she does have some discussions where people bring up the issue of Buddhism, and there is a bit of discussion about Buddhism. There's nothing I can see about Hinduism, but there is, or even Islam, but there is a bit about Buddhism.
I wonder if, as someone, since Octavia Butler came from a Christian background, it wouldn't surprise me. I would feel, as a writer, hesitant to attack a faith that I didn't fully understand myself. So, because it's something that has deep roots in her, she felt able to engage with it in a meaningful way. I would never want to, I don't think, write deeply and significantly about Islam, because I feel like I don't know nearly enough, and I don't have the feeling of it in me to be able to do that fairly. And I think you have to be very close to something like that even to be able to critique it. And so it probably has to do with where she came from in her own life as well.
Yeah, I just think it's interesting how she, okay, I'm looking forward to reading the parts where she does talk a little bit about Eastern religion in the book, but I'm just saying that, like, there's it seems like that, you know, there's a one particular established religion, like you were saying, that has proven its irrelevance at this, and maybe even the cause of this dystopian civilization or anti-civilization that they currently live in, or the setting of the book. And she's saying, and it seems like you, someone was saying earlier, like she's bringing in, she's sowing earth seed, okay? When you look at the parable of the sower, that's the belief system that she's sowing, and to replace Christianity. But sometimes I think that, and yeah, Christianity could be a big part of her life, her life experience, but the only thing that, that I have a problem with is sometimes when we attack certain religions, we're attacking a particular perversion of it, you know, not or a misinterpretation of it. And it seems to me like, you know, Christianity, the way that she writes about Earthseed, you know, you can see that it's almost like she's replacing Christianity, and that there are certain elements of the Earthseed religion that are, I guess, more relevant to the human condition than an outdated Christianity. It's got outdated lessons, and a lot of people think that. Also, it seems like she's portraying Christianity as a religion that offers like a distant type of God, whereas, you know, Earthseed, you have this accessible God in all of your actions, you know, and you can access God in your actions. And anytime you institute change or what have you. But again, there's that is based on like a misinterpretation of the faith of Christianity, because Christianity doesn't offer a distant God. It's actually true. Christianity is based on a personal relationship. So, you know, I don't know how, why she chose to. I just think that it would have been that Earthseed in and of itself in the books of the living is a great. I think it's a wonderful faith. It's a wonderful religion. I just don't see how, you know, juxtaposing it with Christianity, how that sort of added to it or took away from it. It doesn't, and like you said, yeah, because it was the religion of the establishment at that time, which is probably why she chose that particular religion. But I don't know, I just think that Earthseed in and of itself could have, because she when you get later on into the novel, she has, because what it looks like to me is like everything that's gone wrong in society and the world and civilization is due to that Christianity, that established religion, its influence on society eventually led to this. You know, there's violence in the book. There's, all of these, murder, just a lot of just the way that society is no longer safe because of that. And I just think that I don't know if that's something that she's saying. So if we look at this, so can a belief system really have that much of an impact? You know, sometimes one of the things that I felt was missing when I was reading the parable of the sower and I guess the talents is you know, I love the flashbacks when she would write about to give me somewhat of a clue as to more specifics as to how did society get to this point. You know, what in particular, you know, give us a process of breakdown. You know, I mean, I know we were talking about Gebser earlier, and he dealt a little bit with looking back at history and looking at the patterns of history to have a predictive idea as to how societies break down. But I don't know. Like throughout the reading of the book as a group, if anyone has any thoughts or ideas, or if they pick up on anything, they give me some idea as to how society got to that point where it just totally breaks down. What caused it? Because it was obviously some type of a worldview. That was related to that faith of Christianity. So,
well,
interesting to see.
Can I respond briefly? Because I know we're getting close to the top of the hour. Because I've been very stimulated by this conversation. And reflecting upon my own experience, as a gay man in the 90s, I was working for a gay organization dealing with AIDS. And there was many, and there were, you know, different races, different genders, different socioeconomic situations. So it was a real learning curve for me. But I remember when dealing with Bible thumpers, and I come from the Southern Baptist childhood, when the Bible thumpers would come in and say, "You're all going to hell," I used... "He who is without sin, cast the first stone." And, you know, the Bible thumpers were like shocked that I could quote scripture. They weren't really prepared for that. And my intention was to protect people who were very vulnerable. And some of them were very sick, or some of them had, you know, all kinds of issues. But I wanted to protect them from this kind of abuse of the scripture, of the official kind of use of the scripture. And this was back in the 90s, I think, when she was writing this book. And I'm very moved also, because I thought of Christ as a performance artist. And he would just get in these very difficult zones, and he would switch things around and juxtapose those, you know, juxtapose domains. Because he never said about that adultery was okay. He just said, who among us can cast the first stone, which is creating a different kind of level from which people have to organize their behavior. And then no one could cast the first stone because that would be incredibly blasphemous. Mm-hmm. And they all disperse. And he said to her, who hath condemned thee, woman? And she says, no man, Rabbi. And he says, nor do I condemn thee. Go thy ways in peace. And then I'm remembering something that a novelist, a very postmodern novelist, Reynold Price, I believe his name is, he said, but where is she supposed to go? And I thought that kind of question that this postmodern novelist was bringing to this parable was extremely interesting. Got me to thinking, yeah, Jesus, where is she supposed to go? where are we who have been treated as outcasts supposed to go when we've been thrown out of the village? And do we want to really go back to the village anyway? And so these are the kind of questions I think that, because I think Reynold Price is complaining because he says our contemporary church has failed to deal with race, failed to deal with gays, failed to deal with gender. And these colossal failures have created these breakdowns. So I'm just very stimulated by this conversation and just want to express my appreciation for this opportunity to, explore these sort of gray areas in our experience together. Thank you.
So I would like to say, Katina, that I didn't have quite the same impression as you did about the books. That is to say, clearly, yeah, she talks about religion and she's obviously talking mostly about Christianity, but she tends to talk about religion. She uses the word religion rather than the word Christianity. And she's talking about all religion, I think, as opposed to the religion that she's proposing. And the other thing is, I don't see her blaming religion for the desegregation of society. She seems to, I mean, there may be a little bit of it, but it seems to me that what she says at some point is that it's the choices that we made in the years leading up to this, that where we didn't pay attention to what was going on and we made choices and we're stuck with the consequences of those choices. It's more a political argument or an activist argument or an anti-activist argument than it is a religious argument, at least the way I understood it. But maybe we can come back to this discussion as people read forward on the text and possibly get some different perspectives on it at that point.
No, I really love John's, John, what you shared just now earlier. And yeah, you're right. One of the things about when you said that the theologian had challenged sort of Christ and said, okay, but where is she supposed to go? And I think, I know in, you know, readings of the New Testament, he answers the question. He says, you know, pick up your cross and follow me. You know, so, because that's who he represented, was the outcasts and the castaways of society. And it's like, you know, and I guess the reason why I pick up on it why I'm more sensitive to the way that she compares the two religions is because, I mean, it is the birth of a new, she's trying to birth a new community, like a new way, a new type, a new way of living, and a new sort of like a different type of perception of reality that's based in community. You know, where everyone depends on each other and build up to build up this new community. And so, you know, I do think that she probably, yeah, it is. She is talking about like religion in general gone awry, because she, I remember the parts in the novel that she does mention other religion. There's so much, she mentions it so much, and she ties it, and she could, I mean, as you read the novel, you'll see that a lot of times when there's scenes of violence or something that gives us a glimpse into just how devastated the world, the devastation that this novel takes place, she does talk about even the relationships in her life, like someone talked about with her father, like it being the faith of her father that she was abandoning for Earthseed. And it just seems to me like that the world, I feel like it was more than just individual choices that led to this type of devastation, the choices that people made. I think that those choices had something similar in common, that they were made with motivated by a particular worldview. And so I'm just trying to, I guess I was just trying to look into what kind of worldview is she rejecting here? Because we know what kind of worldview she's embracing, but there's also a worldview that she's rejecting. And she's pretty specific about it, but I guess I'll look for that throughout the novel as I, reread it.
So we're up to the hour. I mean, we can stay on if there are people who can, but for a few minutes, if the discussion's not over. But I know, Marco, you had, I think, yes. It's a tour de force that you're still here.
We have more talk scheduled, right? So we'll pick up on these themes, and I'm going to be paying attention to this question of what's being rejected, what's being embraced, and what are the worldviews or the ideologies or the ideas that inform the choices that whose consequences we have to live with. I think those are really great inquiries. And could we just, before I go, at least, can we talk a little logistics? Like, is it next week or 2 weeks from now? And then
it's next week, and then
for everybody too, because that seemed to be an issue.
Yeah, it's next week, and then every 2 weeks up until early October. It's just that the 2 weeks at that point falls onto the Gebser conference, and since I signed up to go to the Gebser conference, I can't run the meeting at the same time as I'm attending the conference. So I suggested that we slide that meeting back a week. So it leaves a 3 week gap, and then two meetings at once, and then a wrap up meeting to follow that. So, but it's next week, and then every 2 weeks from there. Okay. Next week for the first one.
And then on the time?
The time, if it works for people, Katina, you said that even the time worked for you, it just sometimes it doesn't. Is that what I understood?
Yeah, 12 p.m. is fine, because sometimes it doesn't, because I have to work. Sometimes I work online, but if they don't need me for that, it's not every day. But the dates that you have listed, I can make those dates, the 15th and the 29th. I just had to go online and adjust my schedule.
Yeah, understood. Yeah.
And also, if you miss anything, these videos will be up shortly, so you can always review whatever you missed.
Oh,
and that's
great.
A great way of updating yourself too, if you forget stuff like me. So just to
and to reiterate what Johnny said earlier, the way we do this is it's both the forum, both the video chat and the recording of the video chat that goes up on the site, plus the discussion on the forum. So if we engage with each other through the forum, then those people who are at, like Mary, who is absent for a number of weeks, will still be able to take part in the exchange and the conversations around the discussions, because there's an opportunity to post questions or thoughts or comments or whatever about the discussion. So you can view the videotape of the video recording And then if you have additional comments to make, you can make them on the forum and people will reply because we're used to doing this. So it's a way to keep the engagement up even for people who don't make every meeting. Mary, did you? You need to unmute yourself. You said something.
Sorry, no, I had nothing to say. I was just agreeing. And the time's good for me. And I'll be excited to come back from my trip and see what you guys have been doing. So. Yeah.
So I guess we'll call it off there since we've had a good go around for 2 hours. And see you all next week.
Thank you all.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a lot of fun.
Nice meeting everyone.
See you next time.
See you.
Have fun. Bye-bye.